So hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Another very important podcast, videocast, webcast thing we're doing today. A return guest. You're in an elite group of returning guests. So we've got Daniel Owens of the Healthcare Safety Investigation Branch with us. Now, the last time he was on, Daniel was talking about an important patient safety case, and this podcast is the same actually. So there was a warfarin case where a gentleman sadly passed away, and there was a report done off the back of it basically. And Daniel was one of the lead investigators. So yeah, I just thought I'd get him on, and very kindly he agreed to come on and have a chat about it really. So Daniel, probably do you want to sort of introduce yourself again and say a little bit about yourself, and then maybe I'll go into a bit of a brief commentary about what happened, and we can just have a chat.
Yeah, certainly. Thank you very much for having us back on. Really do appreciate it. So, as you say, I'm Daniel Owens. I'm one of the national investigators at HSIB. About 3 years into post now. I think we touched on previously that we're quite an MDT sort of team, lots of different backgrounds and experiences from aviation, military, healthcare, safety science, all sorts of things. Personally, I was a solicitor back in the dark days, moved into healthcare around 10 years ago, and I've been looking at patient safety since.
Very good. So you're, and you find this area interesting from your own professional point of view?
Yeah, incredibly interesting. I think there's some real value in the work we can do, and also just being able to discuss what we do with people like yourself on this podcast is really, really useful.
Perfect. And just before I go into the case, help me understand who pays for the healthcare investigation branch.
Yeah, so HSIB currently is directly funded by the Department of Health. Our remit is for England only at the moment. There is and has been a long-standing intention that we'd become completely separate as an arm's length body. We're waiting for legislation for that to happen, but little things keep getting in the way, like Brexit and the coronavirus pandemic, which are really unfortunate, obviously for a number of reasons. But from our perspective, it's just delayed our ability to become that little bit more independent.
Mm-hmm. I think every organization's, I'm a way to use cliched words again, it's unprecedented, everyone's pivoting, everybody's zooming and all the rest of it, but I guess we've got to get on with it and understand what's happening. Anyway, I'm going to give a brief overview, and probably the best thing to do initially is let's talk, because we're pharmacists and pharmacy technicians, we like the detail. So what I'd like to do is go through the process of, or not the process, like the stages of what actually happened.
Yeah.
So I'll set out the scene. So the report published sets out a case where a medication error with warfarin contributed, unfortunately, to the death of a 79-year-old gentleman. So basically, we can go into detail in a minute or two, but the patient had suffered a fall at home and was admitted to hospital. An error on his chart whilst he was on the ward led him to receiving a number of extra doses, which he did not normally take before the error was spotted by a ward-based clinical pharmacist. The patient developed internal bleeding and unfortunately deteriorated due to several health reasons, and sadly died 21 days after his first admission. So the report highlights the growing aging population that the pharmaceutical care of older people can be complex. Multiple medications, as we know. And in this case, the HSIB examined the patient was on 12 different medications and supplements at the time of admission. And by day 9 of his hospital stay, this had increased to 16. So there are recommendations and bits and pieces that have come out of the report. I don't want to just parrot it. But could you take me through, I mean, particularly, you know, what happened at that moment? Can you sort of set the scene and take us through that patient journey, Daniel? Would that be okay?
Yeah, I can certainly do my best. So I think it's important to say, in the context of this particular patient event, the particular trust where this happened was on black alert at the time. So I'm sure we're all familiar, OPA level 4, huge demands on the system and operational pressures in place. So as you fall at home, he attended AED a couple of days later, went through to medical assessment unit. On the medical assessment unit, he had a medicines reconciliation done by a clinical pharmacist really quickly and very well done. However, what we think happened is after the point of reconciliation and either immediately before his transfer or on transfer to the ward, our patient took on another patient's warfarin medication chart in error. And we explore a little about why that could have happened in an appendix to the report. But essentially, our patient was sharing a bay with a patient that did routinely take warfarin. Our patient didn't. And somehow our patient's identity sticker became attached to the other patient's chart. And following that, it was placed in our patient's medical records. That meant that when he was transferred to the ward or at that point of transfer, for all intents and purposes, he was taking warfarin if you looked at his medical records. And over the course of the following few days, he received potentially 3 or 4 doses on the ward. There maybe was a dose in the MAU as well of warfarin that he should not have been taking. And subsequently, that led to the bleeding being developed. And it was only on day 11 that a clinical pharmacist essentially had the time and the capacity to review our patient's medication chart, his records, in light of how complex his care was, identify the error and really flag that warfarin should be stopped.
And what was the nub of the issue? Why did that sticker get put on the wrong chart?
It's really challenging because we don't really know. And that's why the report doesn't necessarily focus on how that sticker became stuck on that chart. What we've said is a medication error like that could be induced by a number of different means. So there's a number of reasons why people could end up on the wrong medication. Particularly in regards to the sticker, what we think may have happened is that a warfarin chart was completed for the other patient, but that other patient's details weren't put on that chart. And likely at the nursing station, a collection of paperwork has been picked up and other patient's warfarin chart has been in that paperwork. And quite likely when someone's looked in our patient's medical records and seen a warfarin chart without an identity sticker on, they've thought, better put a sticker on that, otherwise it'll go missing. And that's all we can assume.
And Thanks. Could you tell me what was everyone doing? Who was that's the patient broadly, and we've sort of summarized that quite briefly, possibly a bit too briefly, but never mind. How was everyone else behaving at this time? So who was involved? What were they doing? Where were they? I assume there were nurses involved. There were doctors, consultants. Yeah. There's a hierarchy there, isn't there? How was all that let's take from day one to day 21, whenever he passed away?
I think it separates itself into sort of two periods, really. So firstly, there's a period on the medical assessment unit of just over a day, if that. The MAU in this case was actually a pharmacy-led service in this trust. Greatly enhanced pharmaceutical care provision, 24-hour day pharmacy support, rapid reconciliation of medicines, very, very effectively done. When our patient was transferred to an older person's ward, they had clearly the nursing team on that ward were looking after them. They had a consultant in charge of their care and associated junior doctors. They had one band 6 pharmacist covering 2 older person's wards, which routinely would be about 26 patients per ward, or maybe even 28 patients per ward. And what would happen in black alert is each ward had an additional patient added to that patient cohort. Another important factor, I think, from the pharmacy aspect is the, as far as we're aware, no dedicated pharmacy technicians available to support the pharmacist on that ward or over those wards at that time. So there's significant burden of work and responsibility on a single pharmacist tasked with reviewing half of that patient population's medicines every day.
Interesting, you mentioned pharmacy technicians. So what do you see their role? Were they weren't involved at all here, did you say there?
No, they weren't. And that's why the report doesn't necessarily examine the technician in more detail, because it wasn't available in our reference case. But certainly from engaging with pharmacists more broadly, the value they can have to pharmacy services was well recognised. And there were certainly thoughts that if greater technician support had been available, maybe that would have freed up the pharmacist for more time to maybe address patients like the one we see in this case.
That's interesting. So there must be, there's obviously been a move to, and nothing wrong with going towards pharmacy technicians, but for me, two pharmacists would be a better option. So is there cost pressure coming in here, or?
There may well be. It's not something we've explored in the report, but certainly what we comment on the report is sort of the availability of pharmacists at present. And we heard there were challenges in recruiting not just pharmacists, but technicians across the workforce. And the ability to understand, as I think we're going to discuss, the value that pharmacy can bring isn't necessarily measured in the cost of employing a pharmacist, but all the other benefits you may get from that.
Cool. And what were the doctors doing then? How were they involved? Obviously, there was a doctor clearly prescribed this warfarin. What was their involvement and response to the thing, and how were they? Have you any idea how they were involved as the days went on, or?
Yeah, I mean, we summarise that in the report, and I think it's worth saying that in the start of the report, we go through the different, almost the mechanisms that you would normally say, well, they should be identifying a medication error. So we talk about handover and the limitations in the handover that could have flagged this. We get to medical care, we talk about a consultant being in charge of our patient's care. Our patient was admitted with a suspected fractured hip. He was in a lot of pain. He was quite confused at some points. When we spoke to the medics, their focus was very much on that presenting complaint. And given our patients had 12 medications previously, and as you say, that went to 16 medications, there may not have been the time to do that comprehensive review that certainly even speaking to the medics felt they could have done. Or we spoke to doctors who say, well, I always look at the medication chart and I'll do a comprehensive review, and they will and they'll try to. But when you're trying to get through that number of patients in that pressure situation, it's about the MDT operating effectively. It's not down to individuals. Specifically in this case, we also touch on the report the fact that the record system was a bit, there wasn't an entirely record system. There were some concerns that things may not have been recorded in charts previously, hard to find other things on PDF files. So essentially, the consultant looked at our patient's presentation. Our patient was also taken, I think it was bisoprazole. The consultant thought warfarin was likely to have been given to him because he had atrial fibrillation. That wasn't noted on some records, but that wasn't unusual because sometimes things weren't noted on the records and it was hard to find them. So on that basis, there was no, well, certainly the consultant felt there was no reason to question the warfarin because it wasn't part of that presentation. The juniors then took on the task of dosing the warfarin. Our patient had an INR range, well, the patient whose warfarin medication chart it had been had an INR range noted, and not unsurprisingly, when our patient had his blood test taken, his INR was one. But rather than that being a flag to, does that mean our patient's not on warfarin? With everything else supporting that he may have been, that became a flag to, we need to increase the warfarin doses to get our patient's INR up.
And I must apologize. I've been a pharmacist about this. Sorry.
No, feel free.
Days 5 to 11 interest me. And also the question I'm going to come on to, I suppose, maybe to preface that, I suppose, well, let's go for that first. So what opportunities were there? The reason I asked this question is because it's not a criticism, but there was less detail around what happened between day 5 and day 11 in the report than I perhaps would have expected. So are you able to say, and maybe if the information's not there, you can't say, but are you able to say what opportunities were missed within that time frame specifically?
I think the detail in the report is to set out that broader theme, and the patient was receiving other care that we've not focused on because it's not the subject of this report. I think missed sometimes give the impression that it should have been captured, and I think we missed some of the complexity involved. So yes, our patient was reviewed by junior staff. He was dosed for warfarin. A pharmacist actually saw him on day 9 and was able to check his chart, but it was the nature of those interactions. They were not, well, certainly staff didn't have the ability to sit down and do that comprehensive review of our patient that was required. They were responding to his immediate care needs in the same way they were trying to respond to everyone else's immediate care needs in a hugely pressured environment at the time. And certainly, I think, as we say in the report, pharmacy didn't really form part of the MDT on this ward. They weren't able to. And that integrated way of working wasn't present. That may well have added up lots of bits of information everyone had in their head to maybe catch this earlier. that actually wasn't able to be caught until, I think there's a chart in our report showing the activity levels of the ward, and it's not, I think, surprising that the day the pharmacist has time to sit down and go through things is the day that the activity slows down and there's actually time to focus on the patients that maybe need this rather than the med recs, the discharges, and people that have been transferred.
So I suppose the positive take on it that some of my colleagues in the pharmacy press immediately jumped on was, we need pharmacists everywhere, which I would totally agree with, obviously. But I think it's a bit more complex than that, actually. Does the HSIB have a view on what good looks like in terms of what a pharmacist in a hospital should be doing? And if so, or if not, how does the report or what you find in the report compare to what good looks like?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of points there that are really sort of helpful to understand. I think as an investigation body, we aren't the experts in pharmacy. That's very clear. What good pharmacy services looks like is for the profession and for people in healthcare to map and understand. What we try and do from our report is shine the sort of safety science lens on it and say, well, what do you mean by good? Is good numbers? Is good metrics? Is good, what we try and refer to in the report, resilience? So a service that operates to try and identify as many medications as possible within the constraints of the system. And for us in the report is trying to shine a light on that practice that improves resilience and really helps integrate pharmacy into the MDT and understand their role, as we say in the report, the clinical medicine specialist, the person with that knowledge. And I think I said to you previously when we spoken, nothing in that report around the role of pharmacy in the sense of pharmacy can make a difference is any surprise to anyone. I think what we try and do sometimes is say, well, if this isn't a surprise, then why hasn't it happened?
Fair point. I think I do love disagreeing with folk, Daniel. So yeah, I'm enjoying this chat. It's good. I'm not a massive fan of the word resilience. I think so it's used in a number of different settings. You know, pharmacists are told we need to be resilient and so on and so forth. And I think the problem with that term is that it assumes that things are bad and that it assumes that we have to cope.
I'd agree entirely. And I want to be very clear that we are drawing a huge distinction, because being from the NHS myself, resilience typically in the NHS, from my experience, means things are bad, cope with it. Mm-hmm. And there are mechanisms in place to help us do that, but it's very much a personal resilience. What we refer to in the report is the idea of organisational resilience. So it's nothing about the individual. It's about how organisations anticipate, adapt, respond, and build services to do that without having to rely on that personal resilience of just saying, work a bit harder.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to, sometimes when I'm seeing patients, I come to a point and I summarise the consultation. So what we've got here, because there's other bits I want to go on and chat about. So what we've got here is, hospital pharmacy or hospital setting.
Yeah.
Patient goes in to hospital on multiple medications, doesn't have AF or any indication for an anticoagulant, gets warfarin, doesn't see a pharmacist until well into his stay and long after he gets the warfarin that isn't indicated. Every interaction is, well, some of the interactions are recorded on the chart. Everything's paper-based.
Yep.
The role of the multidisciplinary team is unclear from the report. What everyone was doing is not clear, if I'm honest. And then, unfortunately, on day 21, the patient passes away. I mean, I was a bit nervous. Well, not nervous. I don't know. I was a bit cynical when I saw the key messages coming out of this report were that every hospital needs a clinical pharmacist. Well, to be honest, if every hospital needs a clinical pharmacist and it pans out the way it did in this report, then we're in bother, really. It's much more about the process and the human factors and, organizational resilience. So when you saw, I mean, next question is, did you see the response from the pharmacy profession? Did any of the bodies that you specifically mentioned, I think NHS England and the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, have they responded? And have pharmacists in general responded? And if so, what was that response? And based on that response, what does that say about our profession and our willingness to improve?
So, NHSEI, the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, are subject to some of the recommendations in this. So, they engage with us during the consultation. Under our process, they've got a formal period to respond to those recommendations of 90 days. So, we'll see how they respond, but certainly the recommendations were positively received. I think from the profession side of things, obviously, I'm not a pharmacist, I'm not involved in the profession. I've kept a sort of a watching eye over Twitter to see what kind of activity we've had around the report. I think it has been positively received, hopefully for the right reasons in regards to the questions you pose around what is a good pharmacy service, what does resilience mean, what does the system look like to make sure we can operate effectively. I mean, certainly what we don't say in the report is put a ward pharmacist in every ward and you'll be sorted, because it's not that easy. It never is. What we're trying to say is, using the pharmacy resource we've got, we have to understand how we use you better and account for things that happened in not just this event but other events to get the most out of pharmacy and actually integrate you more into the MDT and see what value you can bring, because there's huge value in this service. And it's not just on the ward, it's end to end across hospitals that may not be fully realised in how pharmacy services are currently organised or operated. And we saw that in the variation we found across a number of trusts.
I think I don't know if this is a worthy comparison or not, but I mean, my question here, I suppose it's around medication errors and how risky medicines are, and I guess it's a bit of a blunt question, but why are medication errors an issue that no one cares about?
I don't think it's right to say that no one cares about them. Huge focus on medication errors and how we actually address those. I think it's just where we direct that and how we interpret it. And I think quite often we have a focus on medication errors being quite personally based. So if someone is responsible for giving the wrong medication, that's the final link in quite a long and complex spider web that gets you to that point of someone giving the medication. And hopefully we've explored some of that in this report to say it's not just the junior giving the warfarin or the nurse administering it. It's personal levels, it's team levels, it's ward levels, it's organizational levels, and it's national levels that all lead into that happening.
I'm going to quote one of my very good friends and colleagues, and she's now chief executive of the International Pharmaceutical Federation, Dr. Catherine Duggan, and she'll enjoy this because I'm going to quote her original PhD, which I was lucky enough to read. So she said that, or her the thrust of her PhD was around medication errors and so on and so forth. And she said back then that pharmacists, when delivering pharmaceutical care, need a pragmatically paternalistic environment or framework within which to work. And her hypothesis was that that would improve patient safety. Do you think something like that would have helped in this case?
I mean, in regard to pragmatically paternalistic, could you just explain a little around how
So I
you've seen that
mean,
working?
yeah. So I mean, think of it like when you go bowling in the bowling alley. It's like having bumpers on. So it's quite a tongue-in-cheek question because it assumes actually that the pharmacy profession is failing at the moment because there are medication errors.
And I think we were quite conscious that we didn't want to draw a conclusion in this report because it's not there, and we hope people don't read into the fact that medication errors are the responsibility of pharmacy staff who should catch them. That is not the case. Medication errors are a responsibility across an MDT. It just happens that, as to use that term again, the clinical medicine specialist, you are the ones that end up that tend to end up catching it. And certainly, I think what we've echoed in the report is speaking to staff that aren't pharmacy based, or speaking to the medics, the nurses, they were all really positive of the value pharmacy had, but they referred to pharmacy often as their safety net. So something that'll catch you if you fall. But then we spoke to pharmacists on the ground who, some of them had aspirations of doing that, saying, yeah, we'd love to do that, but we need to point out the big holes in our net because of the lots of the reasons we've spoken about. So yes, we've got a net, but it may not stretch the whole way and you may end up falling through it.
I'm going to take a segue here because I want to talk about hierarchy.
Okay.
And I know comparisons with aviation and all are fraught with difficulty, so I'm not going to go there. But one comparison I think that is quite interesting is the notion of hierarchy. Now, one thing we've learned, well, I've learned running pharmacy in practice and doing lots of articles on bullying and various other topics from a people perspective within pharmacy, is that there is a hierarchy in the NHS. And I'm going to quote Robbie Burns here. So he said, oh, what some power the gifty gave us to see ourselves as others see us. So with that in mind, how do you think the rest of the, or could you describe how the rest of the multidisciplinary team perceive pharmacists?
I can certainly talk through that from two aspects of the investigation. So if we look at the reference event we speak about and the patient, pharmacy didn't really feature in that MDT as an integral part. And throughout the investigation, we referred to sort of how pharmacy almost orbited the MDT, a bit like an electron going around a nucleus. So the MDT included medical, nursing, physio, OT, social workers, discharge staff, but the pharmacy service wasn't integrated. And largely that was because the pharmacists just couldn't be there. They were covering too much capacity, too much patient space. They couldn't be in two places at once. In that particular system, what we saw is that the way pharmacists interacted was very much by notes on a paper record, snatched conversations with people in corridors. That, I don't think, helps the idea of how the hierarchy is challenged, because you're not engaging with people in the same professional way you're engaging with others. On the flip side, as we highlight in the report, we saw some really good examples of where pharmacy was well integrated in critical care units, for example, where we sat in meetings where pharmacists would input as equals, and more than equals, they were deferred to as the specialists around certain issues. And similarly, when we went to organisations that had very well integrated pharmacy services across wards, we had some really, really high praise of the role they had in bringing a different perspective and specialty to the MDT. And I think it is very much the you don't know what you've got until you try it sort of approach. And once you see the value, maybe that hierarchy floats away a bit. But without it, and without engaging at the same level, I think it can potentially be an issue.
I mean, before the call, we were having an interesting chat about business. And I do think, like, pharmacists are just, it's such a cliche to say it, but they really are such an incredibly useful resource. But for one reason or another, no one cares except us. And we're within our echo chamber. We think we're great. I think the rest of the multidisciplinary team really appreciate it when we pick something up and, you know, maybe save a life, or, you know, pharmacists are saving lives absolutely every day across the country. But if it was a business case study, and pharmacy was the product, it just feels like no one's buying yet. I know we've come a long way. We've come a long way. But this report really, for me, worryingly describes how, in my opinion, pharmacists in hospitals and elsewhere are still really on the periphery. And what you've outlined in that report describes that. You know, there was no mandation for a pharmacist to be involved in that person's care, you know? I believe in America, for example, a pharmacist has to sign off that every drug there has an indication. I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure there's something around that. So there's no, I think, and I hope I'm not coming across as frustrated, but there's no mandated involvement of a pharmacist. So I guess I've come full circle where I was a wee bit cynical about the initial response that, oh, every hospital ward should have a pharmacist. Well, of course it should, but I'm much more interested in why the product, i.e. the pharmacist, isn't really being purchased yet. You know, I was just going to say as well, we talked before about the business example of Nespresso and how, you know, Nespresso were clever clogs. They basically managed to get people, get their customers to buy more expensive coffee. And they managed to get them to walk past the instant, you know. And the reason that came out in their market research was quite interesting, was the factor that made people purchase the more expensive coffee was not the temperature of the coffee, not the machine, not the color of it. It was actually the smell. So I suppose this is a very long-winded, convoluted introduction to the next question. And it is a wee bit abstract, but what is the aroma, or what is the smell that we need to find to really make us like a step change in how pharmacists are viewed?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try my best not to comment on how pharmacists smell in too much detail, but I think more broadly speaking, I think it comes back to the idea of, and one thing we had in our heads, and apologies if this is a complete sort of a misnomer or we interpret it wrong, but one thing we sort of had in the back of our minds during the investigation was how pharmacy is, to take that business analogy, in its current format, we felt it was a bit like a startup, in the sense of, we had the Carter report that said, get out and go and see your patients. That's great. But exactly what you're talking about there is, but no one's defined what that is and what it means. And I think that's why we saw the variation, because presently it's very much organized services based on what you think is best and what you've always done. There isn't that market research almost to say, well, what works? What do people want? What do they need? And in regard to that aroma, again, once people tried it, we very much found that they liked it and they appreciated the input that pharmacy had, and they didn't want to go back, very much in the same way that if you're drinking espresso, you probably don't want to go back to instant. But I think it is that's why the investigation very much focuses on what we start calling the middle bit. So we understand really what happens at reconciliation. We understand the focus at discharge, but there's a huge bit in the middle where maybe we're not as clear as we can be around what we need pharmacy to do and what value they can bring.
I think I've had loads of feedback over the years, but if they say feedback's a gift, isn't it? Like, there was a lot about the report I really liked. But yeah, that we've arrived at my feedback on it, really.
Yeah.
I don't know whether there's going to be extra work around this or whether there'll be future reports, but I think it would be really interesting for you guys as an external body dealing with specific incidents to really describe what you think outside the constraints of the profession, because we're bound up by bias and self-preservation and, you know, pharmacists rule okay kind of thing, you know. That's why your role is so important, I think. Question, you mentioned the term pharmaceutical care. How relevant is it as a process, and what do you understand that process to be, Daniel?
I think it's trying to separate out the process, and hopefully we've tried to say this in the report, that it's a holistic end-to-end overview by not just the pharmacy team but the MDT. It's the ability to interact with that patient as an equal member of the MDT and take that medicine specialty on board. What it isn't, and I think what sometimes it risks being, is very much a satellite service or a transactional service where I've got a medication issue, call in the pharmacist, they'll sort it, and then they disappear again. Mm-hmm. That's what I think the report tries to highlight, that it's not transactional, it's not a bit part service, it's integral to every patient's care, and particularly in the patient population we speak about here, complex older patients with multiple morbidities, polypharmacy needs. It's more important than ever, given our aging population and the healthcare needs we've got, to get that right.
You see, we're going off on one now, but I struggle with the term polypharmacy, because I think it's a bit like the resilience of pharmacy, because it assumes things are bad. You know, you're creating a whole specialty there around bad practice. Now, I know there is appropriate polypharmacy, but my feeling is that the way people perceive that term is too many medicines. That's the first thing that comes into your head. It doesn't engender like this person is on the right number of medicines kind of thing. Do you agree?
And I think just from our perspective, it wasn't, the view isn't the pharmacy bad. That's not how it's referenced in the report. The way it's referenced is to try and get across the fact that if you've got a patient on multiple medications, it becomes that much more challenging to identify things like a medication error or an adverse drug reaction or medications that maybe interact in ways you don't understand. And it's that complexity that adds to the complexity of the care needed, and which is why you need specialists there to look at that. In the same way as anything gets more complex, you need more specialism there to look at it. And polypharmacy, in the sense of, as you've described there, Jonathan, it's not something we looked at in this report. It's not something we've commented on, but it's interesting to understand if that's a connotation that can be taken from it.
And in terms of like steps to improve, I mean, I think the reason I brought up polypharmacy and maybe the reason the conversation's gone this way is because my kind of growing obsession is trying to understand some of the solutions upstream, you know, and that's why I'm asking questions of like, you know, what do you understand pharmaceutical care to be in relation to this case? Like, what is the role of the pharmacist in relation to this case? What is that, to use a cliched modern term from 2020, what is the new normal of pharmacy or the role of the pharmacist? I know you've answered that, but the upstream solutions are much more interesting to me. I'll go first here. I mean, I think there should be a contemporaneous electronic record that when a medicine is dispensed in the UK, it should have a valid indication and that should be signed off by a pharmacist. I think that would help. And I think pharmaceutical care would be reinvented as a result of that. And that's clearly not happening in this case because it's all paper-based and it's all SkiWhiff and all the rest of it. But with that kind of, you know, I've had a go there, but what would your one thing you could change be off the back of this?
I think that's really challenging, because I'll do my best to answer as best I can, but we're often trying to say to people that there is no silver bullet, there's no golden nugget that solves all these problems. It's really complicated, and that's what makes it challenging and why we really have to pull together as a system to resolve it. But I think as far as things as we can change, because we can't clone more pharmacists or just produce them out of the ground, I think electronic record systems have something to do with it, but they have other impacts that maybe aren't always understood. It's about elevating pharmacy as a profession to a core member of the MDT on a consistent basis, because with that comes a range of other opportunities and benefits, not just for individual patient care, but as we say in our report, the fact that once you're integrated in the MDT, you can start sharing your knowledge and learning, and that only helps other people as well then.
And just finally, because I could chat to you all day, and we've blethered, and I've managed to remember that we're still talking about the report, so that's good. It's been brilliant, Daniel, really good. You mentioned some validated tools, and that sort of speaks to my pragmatically paternalistic thing. Well, have you any idea what those are? Is that prescribing assistance, decision making tools, or is it electronic records, or what was that hinting at?
It was some academic work we've referenced in the report coming out of, I think, Manchester and in Luton as well, to very much look at, because one of the things we say in the report is, how can you make pharmacy more resilient or services more resilient? So there's not enough people to go around. Where can you focus services? Well, can you prioritize the patients you look at? In the reference instance, prioritization was very operational focused. So it was, are you being discharged? Have you had a med rec? Are you scoring on news? Our patient was none of those things, but they were taking 16 medications, including quite a few high-risk meds. So those tools, from what we understand, are very much looking at, are there a series of metrics that would indicate where potential pharmaceutical harm could occur? So be it age, number of morbidities, type of morbidity, sex, any injuries, so that you can have maybe more of an evidence-based approach to say, well, these are our risky patients on this particular ward or unit. Maybe that's where we target our pharmacy resource first. And that's not to say organizational focus is wrong. It's just unless we have the full spectrum of information around where our risks are, we can't make informed decisions.
Very good. Daniel, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not going to keep you any longer because you've been very generous with your time. And I just want to say thank you very much. I think anything that highlights this work, which is very meaningful work, is very helpful. So, you know, I'm sure there was many, many hours of work and effort has gone into this report. So please don't take my criticism badly. The fact that I'm interested and really want to discuss it is it should be seen as a very positive thing. I'm very supportive of it, and yeah. Pass on your thanks to the team as well.
No, thank you. No, not at all. Really do appreciate the chance to speak to you. Thank you. And just to echo our thanks to the patients, family and the trusts involved that really helped us as well.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. And hopefully they acknowledge and appreciate all your work as well. So, yeah, thank you very much.